Whereas philosophy is certainly not self-expression. And philosophy, of course, is argument. And you can say, well, is the conclusion true or is the argument valid?
Welcome to Five Questions, the podcast where we don't ask if the conclusion's true or the argument valid, but what they say about you. I'm your host, Kieran Setia. In each episode, I ask a philosopher five questions about themselves. There are two ground rules. One is that follow-up questions are allowed. The other is that the question I'm about to ask doesn't count as one of the five. So, could you introduce yourself, tell us a bit about who you are and what kind of philosophical work you do?
My name's Susan James, and I teach in London at Birkbeck College. The kind of philosophy I'm interested in has become increasingly more and more historical. I've been especially interested over the last few years in the work of Spinoza, and I've used it to talk about a number of different aspects of philosophical work, about philosophical psychology, political philosophy, metaphysics, and so on. And I think one of the nice things about working on the history of philosophy is that you're not confined to any one particular area, and you can explore not only the history of philosophy, but also think about its relevance to us now.
It's great to have you on the podcast, and I do think of you as primarily a historian of philosophy. But then I was looking back at sort of your earlier career in philosophy, just when I was getting in touch with you, and you started out working in social and political philosophy. Is that right?
Yeah, I started out working on theories of social explanation, and I was especially interested in holistic theories of social explanation. So I defended a kind of limited version of holism, which I think is, I'm happy to say, has been much more extensively developed and explored more recently.
And how did the transition happen? How did you go from working on social explanation to working on the history of philosophy?
It's difficult to say. I think I was a little bit stuck when I finished the work on social explanation. And I got interested in historical views about skepticism, which were very much all the rage at the time. And from that, by some sort of gradual process, I drifted into working on early modern moral psychology. At that time, I think people were mostly thinking about the early modern period as interesting for metaphysical reasons, but especially for reasons in the philosophy of science. And those are indeed great questions. But it's striking that if you look at most of the big treatises in early modern philosophy, you'll find a huge section about the passions. And that was what I got interested in. And I ended up writing a book about that.
Well, we may come back, I think, later on to other work in the early modern period and your relation to that part of the history of philosophy. But I'm going to go to the first official question, which is inspired by Iris Murdoch, who begins the podcast telling us that philosophy is not self-expression, but who also wrote, "To do philosophy is to explore one's temperament and yet at the same time to attempt to discover the truth." So does your temperament influence your philosophical work? And if so, how?
I think it must. I suppose I think that our attempts to discover the truth are always aspirational. They're always partial. They're often wrong. They're always contested. And so there are various ways of approaching this question of discovering the truth. One of them is direct. You can just ask yourself, you know, is this claim true? But there are also some indirect approaches. So you might ask yourself, for example, how else might we look at this problem, or how have people looked at this problem? And what might we learn from looking at it differently? I think maybe we could say that these different approaches reflect different temperaments. And if they do, then I'm temperamentally attracted to the second. Perhaps that's why I'm interested in the history of philosophy. I'm happier exploring a problem than I am resolving it.
It's interesting to sort of think of this in connection with the topic of the passions. I mean, were the early modern philosophers who wrote about the passions, did they talk about this kind of topic, the relationship between passion and the pursuit of truth?
Well, on the whole, they thought that the passions were obstacles to truth. that they were liable anyway to distort your understanding of what was going on and make you see things one-sidedly. Although they also allowed that there were some passions that went with the most, as it were, perfect and acute forms of reasoning. There's a certain kind of desire and determination that drives reasoning, as well as the kinds that they describe as part of the imagination, that's to say, you know, the kinds that lead you astray. So I suppose being interested in the passions is liable to be interested not so much in the truth as were the obstacles to it, or the things that drive it or surround it.
The other question that sort of springs to mind to ask about this is about, I get this idea that the kind of temperamental inclination to see things from all sides might incline one to the history of philosophy and trying to understand different and sometimes alien perspectives rather than just directly trying to answer a question. But even in the history of philosophy, there's then the question, what did Descartes think about the passions or whatever that might be? And then there's still a kind of, at that point, there's still the question of truth. And in some ways, I mean, maybe it can feel like a more solid question of truth than one confronts in many philosophical matters, where being confident that one's got it right is even harder than being confident that one's got an interpretation right. So are both things going on at once, a kind of wanting to see different sides of a philosophical question, but at the same time, a kind of solid historical truth that one can affix oneself to?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, if you think of any of the philosophers of the mainstream canon and the way that they are, as it were, sort of constantly reinterpreted and rediscovered, as it were, and made anew, then I suppose that it might suggest, you know, that our searches to find out, you know, what is actually true about what they said don't go very far towards understanding them. You know, there's an awful lot more involved in, as it were, grasping them in some way that, as it were, seems to make sense to us. And we always bring a lot to these texts. So there are, of course, some things that we know to be true in a fairly uninteresting way, you know, such as that here are some words of Descartes, or, you know, he definitely didn't think this, or whatever it might be. But as to what we do with those texts in the history of philosophy, then that's only a small part of it, I think. Does that make sense?
No, that does. I mean, I wonder if there's a transition from this comfort with the idea of multiple interpretations or constantly revising interpretations, a transition from that to the second question I wanted to ask you, which is about the relationship between art and philosophy. So I wanted to ask, is there a work of art that you love in part for its philosophical depth?
I think this is a lovely question. And, you know, there are many, many answers I'd love to give. But I'm going to fix on one, which is I'd like to talk about a painting by Poussin, 17th century French painter who worked mainly in Rome. And it's in the Chicago Institute of Art, and it's called St. John on Patmos. Let me sort of give the game away and say that I think Poussin is interested in a theme that also preoccupies some of the philosophers of his time, especially Spinoza, perhaps. And it's about what different people see and can see. I think that philosophers often talk as though visual perception doesn't vary very much from person to person. There's a sort of idea that you or I, you know, in this light and from this position, will see the same cup or pig or whatever it is. But for someone like Spinoza, anyway, this isn't at all obvious. He thinks that all our visual perceptions are sort of drenched, if you like, in our earlier experiences and our feelings. And he also thinks that some of us are, so to speak, more perceptive than others. This isn't a difficult thought, really. I mean, if a group of people spend an evening talking, then their perceptions of the occasion, what each of them saw, both in the literal sense and in the more extended one, can vary enormously. And Spinoza, among others, comments that when you read different historians, you can hardly believe that they were talking about the same event. Well, anyway, I think that Spinoza and Poussin are both interested in people who see things that others don't see or can't see. And they both take it that the prophets of the Old and New Testaments of the Bible are people who have exceptional perceptual powers. they don't necessarily mean this kind of supernaturally. They're just thinking about a natural fact that some of us are more perceptive than others.
So how does that show up in the painting?
Well, I think that in the painting that I mentioned, Poussin is looking for a way to represent this. And he takes the case of St. John, the author, or the supposed author anyway, of the Book of Revelation. You know, so he could paint a picture of John and also represent some of the visions or revelations that John describes. And in other works, that's the strategy he uses. But in this painting, he doesn't do it like that. When you first see it, what you see is an extraordinarily beautiful landscape, but in a sense, quite an ordinary landscape. It's a bank sloping down to a bay. There are trees, there are ruins. In the distance, there are sunlit hills and so on. In the foreground, there's a very small, very brightly lit figure of a man who's sitting on the ground, and he's been writing. There are pages beside him. But at the moment, if you look closely, you see that his pen is in his inkpot and his eyes are closed. So there's a question, which is, well, what's he seeing? And I think what we are meant to understand is that he is seeing what we are seeing. That's to say, a bit of the natural world, which, as it were, is simultaneously transfigured or divine or something like that. I like to think, anyway, that Poussin is offering us, rather in the way that Spinoza does, a panentheistic vision of nature.
I mean, I pulled the image up on my computer so I could look at it while you were talking, and there is something extraordinarily calm about it somehow, almost sort of geometric in the way in which it's beautiful. I guess geometric seems right for the connection with Spinoza, a certain kind of logic to it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it is very beautifully balanced and it's geometric. But although I haven't sort of studied exactly the geometry of it, it seems to me that it's slightly off key. You know, part of its attraction is that it's not kind of completely symmetrical and geometrical. All the lines are just slightly off. But I think that's absolutely right. And that this is something you find quite often in Poussin, I think, that, as it were, there are pictures of people who are immersed in a massive landscape. And the massive landscape is really what you're meant to think about. But the landscape has this serenity, which I think for Poussin is associated with God. For Spinoza is also associated with God, but more in the sense of nature understood as a whole. And perhaps we could read that back into Poussin too.
I want to ask one last question about this, which is sort of a general question that comes up when one is looking at art that was religious, which is kind of part one, are you religious? But part two, if you're not, how does that complicate your relationship to a painting like this that has a kind of, it's from the perspective of someone who has a faith in the divine?
Yeah, I'm not religious. And I mean, I suppose as a philosopher, I think of myself as a bit anthropological. You know, I don't mind dealing with people who have views that I think are wrong in the end, or, you know, at least that I can't manage to share. So in this painting, and in a philosopher like Spinoza, I mean, the problem is made easier by the fact that I think that these are, you know, these are kind of panentheists, these people. They're not just theists in some narrow doctrinal sense. I mean, in the current circumstances where we're so preoccupied by ecological issues and the vast damage that we've done by, as it were, not thinking about nature as a whole, then I think there might be a kind of added attraction to thinking about this view in our own way, even if it's not exactly the same as theirs. Maybe it will help if I can ask you a question. It sounds as though that strikes you as still rather problematic, and maybe you could say why.
I'm not sure if I think it's problematic in some principled way, or just that I find myself periodically having an obstacle to the appreciation of art that is religious. So maybe my favorite composer is Bach, and mostly it's not a problem. And then periodically, I listening especially to his sort of overtly religious music, I will have a sense of dissonance that I'm somehow, you know, I'm relating to it in a way that is somehow cannot possibly be right. And maybe that's a mistake. Or I mean, even to think of it anthropologically is very different from relating to it in the way it must have been for him. I mean, not that even a contemporary religious believer could really access exactly what it was like for him. But that's the kind of thing that I suppose I struggle with.
Well, don't you think, though, that we can never, I mean, obviously, we can never experience what it was like for him. And, you know, we can't fully experience what it was like for, you know, Christian viewers of this 17th century Christian viewers of this particular painting, or 17th century readers of Spinoza, who were so utterly outraged by his views, you know, because at least for those of us who are not theists, the views are not outrageous at all. They're, you know, they're just quite interesting, or perhaps very interesting. You know, so I suppose there's that, as it were, sort of element of distance built into this. But yet I find with Poussin's work that I relate to it. Well, I don't know, this sounds pretentious, but I was going to say, you know, that I find it very easy to relate to, and that my relationship to it is quite aesthetically intense, and it's nothing to do really with the truth of theism or not.
Well, I suppose this also loops back to the very theme that you started with, namely the different ways in which people can see things, and the sort of complexity and nuance of that, and the fact that there's always some sort of gap between however we're seeing things and how we might imagine someone else seeing them, or how much we can access someone else's perspective on them. Well, maybe I'll turn this back to philosophy for question three and ask, have you changed your mind about anything important in philosophy? And if so, how?
Well, one thing I've changed my mind about a long time ago was about our relationship with animals. I hope you'll count this as a philosophical change of mind. But when I was teaching at the University of Connecticut, which is where I started out, I gave a class on the moral status of animals. And this was a while ago, and I asked the students to read a still famous piece by Peter Singer, where he argues that eating meat goes against the consequentialist principle that we should minimize pain. And these students were, like me, of course, brought up in a meat-eating culture. And I think that Singer's essay really troubled us all. And they wrote very eloquent and very carefully reasoned essays about why one shouldn't eat meat. And that helped to solidify my own view. So I did, in fact, stop eating meat then. And I guess that was an important philosophical change of mind for me.
Do you happen to know if many of the students also stopped eating meat? Like, did it have an effect on their lives too?
Well, I wish I knew more. I know that some of them stopped eating meat in the short run.
Yeah.
But later, I have no idea, unfortunately. We'd need to do a survey.
I'm going to ask you one more question about philosophy before we get back to Iris Murdoch. This is question four. Is there a work of philosophy you wish were more well-known?
Well, I've chosen a work which is actually becoming better known, but I still wish it was more widely known. And this is Margaret Cavendish's Philosophical Letters, published in 1664. Margaret Cavendish, as many people will know, is the first woman philosopher, I think, who developed a really wide-ranging philosophy of her own that has survived. And her ideas are, in a way, I think, inspired. This is a word that Catherine Wilson uses to describe them, and it seems right to me. But they weren't influential at the time, and they've only been recovered, really, during the last few decades. They're now getting pretty popular. They are turning up regularly on reading lists, and students are beginning to understand them as part of the philosophical canon. Cavendish communicates her ideas in lots of different styles. I think that's one of the things that's interesting about her. She writes philosophical poems, she writes treatises, she writes philosophical fictions and all sorts of things. But she also wrote a book of philosophical letters. And so that's the book that I've chosen.
So what's the form? Is it, are they sort of imaginary letters between her and other people, or between fictional characters, or actual letters that she was writing to philosophers of the time?
They're fictional letters from her. The conceit is that she's writing to another woman, a lady, who she addresses just as madam, who has sent her various books by famous philosophers, in fact, by Descartes and Hobbes, and by Henry Moore, and by somebody who isn't so well known to us now, but was a chemist called Jan-Baptiste van Helmont. And the lady asks her for her opinion of these books, and she takes the opportunity to engage with things that she disagrees with in the work of these particular writers.
If you had to give a sort of potted summary of what the kind of view was, I have really read no real work by Margaret Cavendish. I think of her as a sort of somehow naturalistically inclined philosopher, but I don't really have a sense of the sort of texture of her view.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting view. And well, anyway, let me just tell you it, something about it.
Sure.
Margaret Cavendish is a materialist, first of all, but a very peculiar kind of materialist, because she thinks that nature, the whole of the created world as she sees it, is thinking and sensing through and through. So every kind of thing, human beings, animals, plants, minerals, is made up of different grades of matter. There's one which is like the stuff, and then there is sensing, and then there is reasoning. And all these are put together in different proportions. So she thinks of each thing as having a capacity to relate to other things of its own. And this view is formulated particularly in opposition to the mechanism of people like Hobbes and Descartes, who think of the natural world as, you know, pretty much inert stuff, which is just matter in motion. Cavendish resists that view strongly, and she argues that, as it were, the causal relationships between things are rooted in their sensitivities to one another and their capacities to respond to one another. I'm putting this rather vaguely and generally, but that's a general idea.
So she was sort of a kind of panpsychist.
Yeah.
Did Spinoza know her work, or did she know Spinoza? What was the, I'm trying to think of the timeline.
I don't think they really knew much about each other. She might have known that Spinoza existed. I'm pretty sure he didn't know that she existed. I mean, it's an indication of the way that in the 17th century, you know, there are quite a lot of important philosophers who are in different ways panpsychistically inclined, we could say. So in England, there's, you know, Cudworth as well as Cavendish, there's Leibniz as well as Spinoza and so forth. And this is sort of an aspect of the early modern period, which I, for some reason, find very attractive, but which has got suppressed until recently in the historiography.
One last question about Cavendish. I mean, I was struck by the fact that she wrote in all these different genres. So she also wrote poetry, she wrote fiction. I think she wrote sort of sci-fi novel, or The Blazing World, which I've never read, but it sounds like a kind of sci-fi utopia fiction. Why the philosophical letters in particular? Why does that come to mind for you as the work of Cavendish to start with?
Yeah, I mean, The Blazing World is an amazing fiction, and it does have quite a lot of her philosophical position in it, because practically all her books do. You know, she likes to tell you what she thinks about things. But I think there are a few things that I especially like about the philosophical letters. First of all, it's an example of kind of philosophy written for a general audience, and also including an audience of women. And so, as she says in the beginning, you know, it's meant to be entertaining and accessible. And the second thing I think is rather charming is that she uses this rather tame-seeming genre of letters to a lady, you know, where you might expect them to exchange recipes or, you know, describe the people who had paid them visits this week or something. Anyway, she uses that genre to make some really radical philosophical claims. And maybe finally, I like this book because you see Cavendish putting herself in debate with the philosophers of her time and engaging in controversy. She's a bit sort of sheepish about this in the introduction, but that's actually, as she says, what she is doing. And so she's trying to give you a sense of where she fits into the philosophical world, and also where some of the sort of attested giants of the age, as she presents them, are philosophically vulnerable. So all those seem to me very endearing and interesting features of the work.
Yeah, it passes the Bechdel test, you know, the Alison Bechdel test for a movie, of whether there's ever a scene where two women talk about something other than a boyfriend or husband or something, and two women talking about the relationship between Cavendish's views and the philosophical views of Hobbes and Descartes seems to pass that pretty well. Yes.
It does.
So the final question I always ask is another Iris Murdoch question. So it begins with another quote. It's always a significant question to ask about any philosopher, she wrote. What is she afraid of? So what are you afraid of?
I'm afraid of lots of things. I'm afraid of being humiliated, being unnecessarily stupid, being aggressive and so on. But actually, putting all those things aside, my own version of Murdoch's question is a bit less specific. I think many philosophers work on topics that they find sort of personally difficult, often unconsciously. And it's worth asking about that. So I suppose that quite a lot of the work I've tried to do has been about the passions. And I find that this preoccupation is never very far away. So I guess maybe I'm afraid of them. But I do think also that they have a sort of uneasy place in the project of philosophizing. At least on one influential view, philosophy is supposed to be, isn't it, a rational undertaking that rises above our individual emotions, our affects. And I suppose, like most philosophers, I must be attracted by that aspiration. But at the same time, I think it's sort of unsatisfying, partly because it involves a suppression of affects that, at least it seems to me, are always at work, even in our most abstract theorizing. So I'm also attracted to the idea that we should try to embrace this aspect of philosophy. But it's true, of course, that doing that is often very painful and disturbing. So something to be afraid of.
Well, maybe we'll end with the painful and disturbing project of embracing the passions and bringing them into relation to one's philosophical work. And I'll say thank you, Sue, for appearing on the podcast.
Thank you, Kieran. This has been really lovely to talk to you.
Susan James is Professor of Philosophy at Birkbeck University of London. She's the author of several books, including Passion and Action, The Emotions in Early Modern Philosophy, and Spinoza on Learning to Live Together. Thanks for listening to Five Questions.